Welcome to MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. If you want to get caught up on our most recent episodes, you can check out themacguffinman.com. We recently talked about Don't Look Now, The Thin Blue Line, Ace in the Hole, and Bicycle Thieves. I also wrote something about kind of everything, every movie I've seen since 2009, so you can read that if you want, or don't. Anyway, themacguffinman.com.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
That sounds like a long article.
I mean, it is the length of my usual thing, so yes.
That sounds like a long
Yes, article. It is true. I still don't have an editor. But the good news is nobody reads them, so it doesn't matter.
And speaking of not having an editor, smooth segue. Yeah. We're talking about Rashomon.
Yes,
a 1950 film directed by Akira Kurosawa and edited by Akira Kurosawa as well.
Yes, famously was his own editor on a lot of his motion pictures.
Yeah, and this is one of the. I think a movie that, or at least a director we've been meaning to get to for a while, mostly because it kind of can't be overstated how important people kind of look at Kurosawa in the history of cinema, right?
Yeah, I mean, his name is referenced in the line of 1990s Bare Naked Ladies song, you know, like he, what other Japanese director has that sort of like cultural clout, you know? I say that like kind of in jest, but it's also a true fact, you know, like Akira Kurosawa is the Japanese director. Like you can make arguments for Ozo being more widely respected, but like the regular person doesn't know who the hell Ozu is, you know?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that if they're going to be able to name one, it's Kurosawa and then Ozo. And then after that, maybe they can name five. But I think for most people, it's kind of one and done, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, even at this point, like, as film is receded from the culture, like, talking about film and film being important, I think fewer people than previously in my lifetime could name Kurosawa. You know, he died in 98, I think. And so there's just been less keeping his memory alive since then. But anyway.
Yeah, no, I was kind of amazed to find that he's, like, in his 40s for Rashomon.
Is he?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of, like, the... A lot of directors going back further, and still now, like, you know, it's like in the 90s when PTA, Paul Thomas Anderson, and Quentin Tarantino were coming up, they were, like, in their 20s. They were, like, 28 when Reservoir Dogs and Boogie Nights came out, respectively. And that was, like, it was, like, notable. They were like, enfant terrible, just because they were youths who were able to direct a movie that was really good, because it's just such a difficult job that it's hard to imagine somebody in their 20s being able to do all of the things you need to do to be able to direct a film. And the further you go back in Hollywood history, like, the less you have, like, young directors, like, really young directors. And it's just sort of now we're sort of used to a lot of unproven names or younger names being given the keys to, like, the biggest movies on the planet, just because Marvel's like, okay, you're young and made a cool 5-minute short. Here's Spider-Man Homecoming or whatever. And it's just sort of become the way to go just to find a young director, partially to keep costs down, and they just sort of trust themselves as a machine to sort of keep things moving. And a lot of studios feel that way about their biggest films at this point. Whereas back in the past, when art used to be valued more than commerce, a lot of the time, I mean, commerce is always an important part, but you know what I mean? You'd kind of want to be able to trust a human being before letting them direct, you know?
Yeah, and I just admittedly don't know that much about Japanese cinema ever, let alone in the mid-20th century. Mm-hmm. So I didn't know how common that was. And just reading this, not only is Kurosawa just well respected just as a director, but very much seems to be the one we point to open, you know, Eastern cinema to the Western world, mm-hmm. and Rashomon in particular.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, he was famously the Hollywood brats, the Francis Ford Coppola, George Lucas famously kind of remade The Hidden Fortress as Star Wars A New Hope. Spielberg loved Kurosawa. Scorsese loves Kurosawa. I can't remember if I mentioned Coppola, but Coppola is a huge fan. Like, the majority of Kurosawa's later work was created partially because people like Spielberg, Coppola, and Lucas helped him get money to make these films. And so, yeah, like, you are right that he very much opened up the rest of the world to, or played a big part in helping open up the rest of the world's eyes to seeing Japanese cinema in general. Something interesting, like I mentioned that we did a podcast about Bicycle Thieves. Something that I hadn't really thought about was that in reading about Rashomon, it sort of feels like North American cinema audiences had a taste for Italian neorealism for a time, which then kind of got replaced by Japanese cinema, partially in no small thanks to this film, Rashomon. And it just sort of got me thinking about all the times in my life when there has been like a series of, you know, films from the same either country or part of the world. Like in the late 2000s, you had a lot of Swedish films or Swedish filmmakers that started to have notable films, Let the Right One In being the most famous example. And that subsequent filmmakers, Thomas Alfredson, I think his name is, he made Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy a couple years later. And there are just these moments in foreign cinema crossing over to North America that are always very brief, and it's something that I had never thought about. And in my research, I found that Rashomon just sort of replaced Italian neorealism in that slot. Yeah,
and it's just interesting. And I mean, coming out of the world wars and globalization becoming more and more prominent, that you know, this isn't very far after the end of World War II, you know, a famously destructive war, obviously, and just that idea of the world kind of being a bit smaller and more accessible. And, you know, not to say anything about just Japanese culture, Japanese cinema in particular, but that people in North America just have a taste for things from different continents, whether it be Europe or Asia.
Yeah, I mean, and the most the biggest event of World War II happened in Japan, you know, so you can easily imagine people finding out a lot more about Japan just because of the bomb, you know.
Yeah, so yeah, and we'll I'm sure we'll get to some of the particulars about Kurosawa bit by bit here, but just to focus on Rashomon for a bit, the term the Rashomon effect, just speaking again about just some of the effect that this movie has had overall, that's kind of something that's just entered the English lexicon. And people sort of credit this movie with being the reason the Academy has a best foreign film category altogether, which I don't know the truth to that, but
yeah, I feel like we said something similar about Bicycle Thieves. now that you're saying that out loud, like I'm looking up Bicycle Thieves right now. Anyway, continue.
Yeah, no, that's why I couch it immediately. But just this this idea of how big it was, and the idea of cinema just becoming, I mean, it was clearly global by this point, but just the idea that it was accessible for people around the world to look at cinemas from different nationalities and kind of treat them honestly.
Yeah, and just to complete my point, I looked up Bicycle Thieves. That film was given an honorary Academy Award in 1950, which is also the same year Rashomon came out. So I guess at the same ceremony, they got very specific Oscars together. So maybe that's why they're linked in my head.
Yeah. So,
or I guess, sorry, the Rashomon Oscars was 2 years later because they're recognizing these films 2 years after they're released. Anyway, the world turned slower back then.
It's true. Yeah. And it turned even slower in, what, 11th century Japan is where we are for this?
I don't know for sure that you're wrong, so I will agree. Yeah. I honestly don't know the answer to that question.
Okay. And I mean, it's made slightly trickier by the fact that, all countries, I think, feel this way in a bit, but Japanese culture seems very interested in its own past, and some things change very slowly or don't change at all. And this, this is the story. I mean, kind of famously, it's several retellings of the same story, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's the tale of a rape and murder from the perspective of four different people. Or three different people in one spirit, you know, depending how you want to look at it.
Right.
Which is a real left turn for me. That caught me by surprise. Yeah. But I mean, and you're right about saying, I mean, this is a movie interested in Japanese history. Akira Kurosawa in general was very, very interested in Japanese history. I think more than a pretty healthy majority of his films were period pieces.
Right.
Yeah. The structure of this movie does not feel like 1950. I guess we start there. It's so, I remember reading about Memento when we did a podcast for that. Christopher Nolan talked about how when someone came into the film, if somebody came into a film mid screening, having already seen the movie before, he was hopeful that they wouldn't be able to figure out where they were in the running time of the movie. Yeah. He wanted it to be that confusing. And I kind of feel the same way about Rashomon, even though it is pretty distinctly split up. It's not, there are real segments to this film, but even the fact that it's just the same action being retold in different ways leads to some confusion, even to me as somebody who has seen the movie multiple times. I can't quite remember which shot happens in which, even going through my notes, I can't remember which shot happens in which story and who's acting this way at this time. Simply because the film is built in a way that's meant to confuse you and eventually give you an answer, but an answer you may or may not believe. And I just found the structure of it to be very, very not 1950, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think a few things about it are, and I think that's what was so notable about it as well. I mean, people talk about that this didn't do that well in Japan immediately, and I think that was, I think that's been kind of blown a bit out of proportion as time has passed, is my understanding. Mm-hmm. But it does seem that this, I think whether people liked it or not, kind of saw that this was something different, and I think part of that... part of that is the structure, and I think hand in hand with that is just this idea of, you know, the Rashomon effect and the unreliable narrator, and that the way that there are different versions of the same story told, and definitely some visual filmmaking techniques that we'll talk about just play with this idea of what truth is. And I think that the further you go back in cinema history, I mean, at the very beginning, it's obviously meant to show, I mean, the whole point of it was to be able to replicate something that's happening in real life, whether it's just a short piece of footage of, you know, a horse running, to go right back to the very beginning. So as we get closer and closer to modern times, this idea that what you're seeing isn't a straight depiction of even a fictitious event, that this movie really runs with that idea. And I think... you know, it's hard to appreciate exactly how different that can be. But at the time, you know, historical accounts make it quite clear that this is something that even the people making this film who weren't Kurosawa had a hard time with the idea that that it's a bunch of different versions of the same story. And most importantly, I don't think any of them are true in the most meaningful sense of the word. Right.
Yeah. No, I agree. I don't feel like even at the end, the last retelling of the story, which is, you know, partially closer to, I don't know, it feels like we're being led to believe that this is what quote unquote actually happened in the last story. And, I don't know, my viewing of the movie, it feels the most accurate, but I think the point of the movie is not that this of the four stories is the one that is 100% correct. I think it's the one, we're meant to believe that's the one that's potentially the most correct, but also it's still a story, you know, and it's still a retelling of something that happened by somebody who we may or may not be able to trust. And yeah, I don't know. I think that's the constant appeal of the movie.
Yeah, and I think that's where Kurosawa leaves it in interviews and in autobiography as well, that there is no one is capable of telling a story without sort of injecting their own subjectivity into it and their own exaggerations and omissions of very important details.
Yeah.
And in the language of cinema, I think we're always supposed to be left with whatever the last version is the right one, right? Any, you know, just a courtroom procedural, we get everyone's different testimony, and the last thing that we hear is either someone breaking down or confessing, or someone kind of cracking the case with one last bit of information, and then the last time through the story is the one that reveals everything to be entirely true. And I think you're right that we get closest to the truth by the end of it, but that's still a very kind of lowercase t truth.
Yeah, no, I agree. And the things I like the most about this film, I think the first few minutes of this movie, like just visually, it just it grabs you like so few movies can. The visuals of the gate that the three men are shielding themselves from the rain. The fact that the rain is just, it's raining so hard for so long, and it's just this powerful, powerful rainstorm that they're surrounded by, and they're just trying to cover themselves up just to get some sort of protection. And I just sort of felt like right off the bat, I mean, coming into this movie without having seen it, I still knew it was a movie about storytelling. As you said, the Rashomon effect is such a famous thing that like we know what Rashomon is about without having seen Rashomon at this point, or at least people like you and I do. And I just thought it was really interesting that the first big visual metaphor used is something as unpredictable as water. And truth is kind of fluid, and you can change. It can change direction depending on which drop you follow, and they are like surrounded by all of these drops constantly. It's like, what, which one of these can we follow? Which strain can we follow into the direction that will lead us to the truth? And the fact that they're also hiding from the rain and to sort of discuss what the truth is, I think further helps that sort of visual metaphor. It's like they're trying to shield themselves from uncertainty to try and figure out what the real story is. And when the wife is telling her story later on, we get one shot of her after she wakes up. She says she doesn't know. When I came to, I was standing at the foot of the pond. You know, she passed out. Her husband was killed while she was unconscious, and she woke up like surrounded by the visual metaphor for uncertainty in this movie's visual language. And I just thought the use of rain specifically right off the bat and through all of the whole film in that one instance in the storytelling of the wife, and also towards the end, I thought it was rain was used very effectively, not just visually, but as a visual metaphor in a way that, like, I feel like if you were to describe it to me, it would sound corny, but immediately grabbed me, and I was just like, oh, this is fantastic. This is a good decision.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, a few things there. In a way that you can probably describe better than I can, just your knowledge of visual cinema being better than mine. Once again, and part of this is just a good cinematography, mm-hmm. but just how striking and good this movie looks. You know what I mean? Just how crisp things are. And I understand that they put some black dye into the water into the rain to make it look as good as it does. But 1950 was a long time ago, technology-wise, yes. And I just don't expect things to look as good as they do in this movie. And again, some of that is simply artistic choices, but it just looks very good in a way that I have to imagine that even if it, you know, someone who without a very good eye was putting this together, I'm still surprised by how good things look in this movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. And also, I know I mentioned this on Bicycle Thieves, but I do think it's something that people don't consider. This is also a movie that has had just an unbelievable amount of care put into the restoring, or I can guess continual storing of it. And that certainly plays a part. Basically, anytime you see a Criterion Collection logo, like, you're just like, okay, cool. The best people in the world worked on this, you know?
Yeah. So to speak about just this idea of truth again and the rain, first of all, I think the first line of dialogue in this movie is "I just don't know" or "I just don't understand" or something, just to set the tone. And then, yeah, we have the rain, and we have good weather during the, you know, the in the past about the story that's being told, and we constantly have rain and these pieces in between, in place in Rashomon, as you said. But, you know, so we have this this fluidity of truth that you talked about, and rain as sort of this obscuring factor. And inside Rashomon, they're trying to hide from it. You know, there's this force of rain, this force of nature that confuses things. And they're huddling up together, trying to share stories to get to the bottom of something and sheltering themselves from the rain. But it's just too much, and it's just too heavy, as you said, and it's too pervasive. And they're still being obfuscated by this. And I think that's really interesting. And yeah, you mentioned the thing about the wife being near the water, and we don't see a ton of the water in the past. You know, we don't have the rain, but we do still see it as this element that confuses things.
Mm-hmm.
And did you put a lot of thought into the use of the sun or sunlight? Because that's something that, you know, just the showing the sun directly the way they do was something that hadn't been done or is still relatively an unknown move that you could pull in cinema at this time, it seems.
Yeah, what would eventually be known as the Terrence Malick and or Sofia Coppola shot. I honestly didn't put a lot of thought into the sun in general. I realized upon reading about this movie that a lot of people have put a lot of thought into it. But I mean, partially just because the rain is right there at the beginning, and it's just more consistent throughout the movie, that I suppose I just sort of thought about that more. And the readings of the sun, which you are right, like something like that, shooting at the sun, directly at the sun, whether or not this is the first instance of it, that's just so difficult to prove. I think, like, just
yeah,
it's sure, like I mean, nobody's gonna point to something at this point, I think, that is like, oh no, this 1949 film did it or whatever. There's a fun story of Robert Altman talking about it. Altman was a huge Kurosawa fan, and specifically this was his favorite Kurosawa movie, talking about how he saw this movie one night, and he was still working in television at the time, and saw this movie one night, and then the next day was trying to figure out how to point a camera at the sun and replicate that shot. But yeah, the something, what I recall reading about it is that this sun was sort of representative of good or evil, and you know, shooting it through the trees is like either the good is trying to get into the forest or the evil is trying to get it into the forest, depending on where your reading is coming from. And just as somebody who is more interested in truth than good or evil, I can see how I would be more interested in the water rain aspects of it. But I'm curious to know if you had any thoughts about the sun.
Yeah, I think I'm still kind of on the notion of truth in this movie, because I think that human nature is definitely present in this. And I mean, to touch on an idea that marries the two of them, I think it's amazing that in everyone's version of the story, they still commit murder. You know, that
yeah.
You know, that they get to tell their version of the story, and everyone is doing, I mean, other than the rape, which shouldn't be left out of this movie, despite the fact that they kind of leave it out of this movie.
Yeah.
You know, it seems to be the major crime that is being investigated here, and it's somewhat something that everyone is claiming. But I just see the way that they do have those clear shots of the sun, but then they also have these shots of the sun with the branches in the way, and that
yeah.
these characters are obscured by the shadows of these branches, and that we always see the sun or light as truth, or just the light of truth being shone on something, and just this idea that darkness can hide all these things, but eventually everything will kind of be shown as it is, and you can hide things for a little while, but in the cold morning light, things will kind of eventually be seen. And for a movie that is famous for showing the sun so directly, I think it's telling that it chooses not to, and it uses shadows in an interesting way, that we have this thing that will that is capable of showing the world as it is, but there are still things that can get in the way, and that there's still you know, people's subjectivity and people's exaggerations and omissions, as I said, that will prevent that. Even though I think that there is a clear truth, despite what Kurosawa seems to think, there is an objective truth, but it's kind of rendered very inaccessible by human nature.
Yeah. Okay. That's a good reading of the use of sun and light. I hadn't thought about it, but I like it.
You mentioned the Sofia Coppola or the Terrence Malick, any other sort of straight lines you want to draw from Rashomon to any other directors? I mean, take your pick, but
I was kind of surprised. I will say, I mentioned Robert Altman. I was kind of surprised to find out he was as big of a, I mean, not surprised to find out he was a big Kurosawa fan, because I've seen Kurosawa films, so I know how good they are. George Lucas, I mentioned this, The Hidden Fortress is Star Wars, and especially those slide transitions, the dissolves that Kurosawa uses, that are just all through Star Wars. There's a million of them.
Those are like, that's Star Wars to me, just because that's where I started seeing those.
No, exactly. And
formative years.
And at this point in my life, I certainly don't see that as Star Wars, but like, the first time I saw Seven Samurai, I definitely probably saw that and was like, oh, it's that Star Wars thing, you know? But George Lucas, yeah, loved Kurosawa. Spielberg, huge Kurosawa fan, and they each have similar tastes in sort of like big epic scenes, with a lot of like physical human beings whenever possible. Scorsese, you can see a lot of Kurosawa in the way that Scorsese, specifically in editing, it feels like Scorsese's editing is a little bit more jagged, but there are certain things that Scorsese, like the feel of a Kurosawa film is closer to a Scorsese film than I remembered. And Scorsese has referred to Kurosawa as his sensei. I know Sidney Lumet loved Kurosawa as well. I can't think of any direct examples of Lumet, like it's something in Network that was indicative or that would remind me of Rashomon. But yeah, I think as a big Lumet fan, I think it's worth noting that he was a big Kurosawa fan. But yeah, I don't know. It's just, I mean, everybody is everybody too much, too long of a name? And Coppola loved him. I have no specific examples that I can think of off the top of my head, but I think it's just sort of the people of a certain age, kind of like we all know Spielberg's techniques and Spielberg's skill set. Kurosawa was that person for the movie nerds in the 1970s. You know, he was somebody that made, I guess a better example for somebody like us is people we've mentioned earlier in this podcast, Quentin Tarantino and Paul Thomas Anderson, people that sort of were creating movies that were like creative and new and vibrant and sort of in ways that were new, but were also playing with things that had been previously well established in our heads in the 10 to 12 years of movie watching we had just of standard American cinema before we got to, in say Spielberg or Coppola's case, before we got to seeing our first Kurosawa movie, or in my case, before I saw Reservoir Dogs. You know, like Reservoir Dogs is good because of all the shitty crime movies I watched before it, you know? And yeah. Just like I would imagine something like specifically Seven Samurai is good because of all of the grand Hollywood films somebody like Spielberg had seen before, but then Seven Samurai just does it better, you know? So I think that's sort of, it's kind of just a time thing and just being, this is the right genius for this age gap, or sorry, this age range, you know?
Yeah, and I mean, we've talked about movies from this era and before from American or European directors that we like, but I think just even the change of the setting plus the change of the storytelling, just to be that much different, to be, you know, it's a period piece, it's on a different continent, just to seem so much different, mm-hmm. I imagine kind of shake somebody a little bit more than, you know, if Rashomon was a Western, which, you know, kind of could be and yep. was in 1964 with Paul Newman. Did you know about this, The Outrage?
I did not know about it until reading about this, and I could not believe it. I mean, especially like it's directed by Martin Ritt, who directed HUD, which is another Paul Newman movie that I like a lot. I have no idea how I had never heard of this movie. It's Paul Newman in the 60s too, you know, like that's my vintage.
And Edward G. Robinson, and there's cool cast. Anyway.
60s Paul Newman is my Paul Newman, you know, like yeah. I'm amazed I didn't know about those.
Yeah, but just for this to stand out in people's memories, obviously it's just a well-made film, but just to be just the added feature of being that much different and
yeah, yeah.
to kind of open your eyes about what kind of stories you can tell. And the, yeah. the one I'll point out that didn't get mentioned, unless you count Your Umbrella of Everything, which I don't think is the wrong answer, is Sergio Leone in the
oh, yeah, yeah.
standoffs and the close-ups. And we talked about a lot about those features when we talked about those movies, but
yeah, I mean, I didn't even get into international directors like Fellini. Yeah. Fellini loved him. Bertolucci loved him. Again, The Umbrella is everybody, you know. Yeah. But sorry, I didn't mean to sidetrack your Leone point.
No, that's one that jumps out to me, and I think is for a feature that shows up repeatedly in the same person's work. I mean, I haven't seen Leone talk about him, but it just, I kind of don't need to, you know. Yeah.
You've seen A Fistful of Dollars, which is an unauthorized remake of Yojimbo, so you know how it goes, you know what happens.
Yeah, and I forget who mentioned this, but when they are at the trial or they're testifying or whatever, and the former witnesses just show up in the back, someone pointed that out as very Kubrick, but that's just a very cool shot as they kind of add up in the background. And I don't know why that stands out to me as interesting as it is, but I enjoy it greatly.
Well, it's because I think why that stands out, and I agree that, I mean, one of the things that Kurosawa was fantastic at is blocking. His movies are like the placement of human beings and the way that human beings move in his movies is not really like actual human beings would sit or move, but it's really interesting cinematically. And I think what you're seeing in those interrogation scenes, as the witnesses start to add up in the background, is that it's such a stark, plain background. And just having anything new in that frame becomes so like, it's just like, oh, this is there, you know? And, he does all throughout this movie, he does a lot of background foreground blocking, like hiding under the city gates with our three initial characters. There's a lot of that as well, where you know, we've got the bandit and the I'm just calling them by their character names as listed on the Wikipedia page, because that's the only way we can do this, I feel like. But the bandit and the woodcutter, they're sitting together as I believe the bandit is about to start his fire, and in the background we've got the priest sitting like far away but still perfectly in the middle of them. Yeah. And then you cut to this overhead wide shot again with the two people in the bottom left frame and the priest in the top right. But there's now also a pillar in between them. There's like this giant pillar that's holding up the gate in between them. And it's just all sorts of things like that. The way Tajimaru, anyway, I'm close, moves just in general, the way he moves, like he whips his head around a lot. He does not move like a human being moves. He moves like a Kurosawa directed human being moves. And there's just so much of this. And another one that jumps out, and this is a perfect example of a shot that I can't remember when it happens in which story, because this action sort of happens in each of them, is the shot from about ground level, and you're shooting between this triangle that is somebody's two legs right in front of the camera, and you see either the woman or the samurai in the middle, and then either the woman or the samurai in the background. I think it's the woman in the middle and the samurai in the background. It's maybe before a duel is about to start, and it's just like, it's staggeringly gorgeous. And there are so many shots in this movie that are just so beautiful. That's not even a touch on the editing, but like the thing you mentioned, Kubrick, the thing that I have mentioned on this podcast previously about Kubrick is that every one of his movies feels like it could not have been made at the year that it was that it was technically released. And I do have comparatively fairly limited experience with Kurosawa, but his movies feel that way to me as well, just in there is like this current of energy running through Kurosawa movies that just doesn't exist in movies from 1950, you know? And Seven Samurai, I think, is 1954. That movie is 3.5 hours, and it, like, it moves so fast, and like, you just never really feel like time is passing, just because you feel so locked into the movie. And I just think something about that really reflects how Kurosawa was ahead of his time, and really helps you see that when you think about that, you think about somebody in 1950 seeing a bunch of movies, somebody like Spielberg, seeing a bunch of movies back to back, like I see a bunch of movies back to back now. The ones that are, that really grab you, are the ones that you remember for the rest of your life. And you can very easily see how somebody seeing 8 movies a month in 1950 would be like, oh, this one's me, you know, this yeah. one's for me. Anyway, I do feel like Kurosawa was consistently ahead of his time in a lot of facets of filmmaking.
Yeah. Something I just thought of when you were saying that, though, about the witnesses adding up in the background, and as we've said, just this idea of truth being so central to this, just everybody's new account of this story, you know, when two people disagree but we have the same results, that's one thing, and then we see more and more people kind of add up, and they all have these contradictory stories of how this person ended up dead and how everyone ended up where they are. And as we see them just pile up in the background, it just reminds us of how many different versions of the truth that we're dealing with here. Mm-hmm. And just to speak about the bandits' movements, this isn't a realistic movie. I mean, for one that does, as I said, really focus on this idea of truth. These are pretty stylized representations of any versions of truth. And as you said, the bandit doesn't really move like a human. He says he chose to move like a lion. But you're right. It's the way that the camera moves is stylized, but the way that these people act, this isn't the, you know, realism movement coming to the fore here. This is this doesn't look like real life. This looks like a movie exploring ideas of truth, but not in a visually truthful way. And I think that's just, it's valuable to notice that. And there are, from what I understand, the Kurosawa movies that are better, or not better, but more concerned with becoming realistic looking. This just is not that.
Yeah, and he was very interested in a lot of Japanese stage acting techniques. So there's a lot of like specific techniques with names that I researched but can now no longer remember. But just specific stage acting techniques, and as we know, just because you have to project more and all that stuff, stage acting is just by nature more theatrical and more like loudly performative. And I really get the feeling that Tajamaru, who is the bandit, is one of those characters in this movie. Yeah.
People who grew up with silent film, right? And as I said, he's in his 40s or maybe late 30s or something, Kurosawa.
Sorry, you cut out there for a sec. Can you repeat that?
Yeah, just that he's late 30s or early 40s or something, mm-hmm. so he's had a lot of time. You know, we're not far from strictly silent movies at this point.
Yeah,
no, exactly. His upbringing was largely informed by that as well.
Yeah, he was born in 1910, so like, imagine how many movies I went to as an 18-year-old, you know, and he's doing that in 1928, you know?
Yeah, and I think it's interesting to point out that the Japanese government, it seems, wanted Ozu's films to be shown. He thought that was more representative of Japanese cinema. And I just find that interesting, because we talk about this being different, and who knows if it was more, more different, more like Eastern cinema, the typical Eastern cinema of the time, if people would have latched onto it as well, if it would be too different, or where if Kurosawa kind of found a line that things were different enough for North American and European directors, but still different enough to be engaging.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously I'm an outsider when it comes to Japanese culture by a mile. As somebody who has seen multiple Kurosawa movies and one Ozu movie, I kind of understand how a government would be more specifically the Japanese government would be more interested in Ozu becoming the filmmaker of the country, that the you know, in the way that the world sees filmmaking from that country, just because, I mean, Kurosawa is all about movement. Ozu is the exact opposite. Like, he makes the slowest, most patient movies, and they're beautiful. Or, well, I mean, the one that I saw was beautiful. I think Ozu, through his career, famously moved his camera exactly one time in any of his movies. Like, if you add up all the shots where the camera pans or dollies or whatever, there's a grand total of one in his career.
Oh man.
Yeah, I'd have to check that, but I do believe that that is a true fact. Because that's
single digits. It's incredible.
Yeah, I know, exactly. But and I think it's a shot of a teapot, if I remember correctly. But so you can just sort of imagine there's certainly Western aspects to Kurosawa's films in that, I mean, he loved Westerns, and you know, we mentioned Yojimbo was his version of a Western, with starring a samurai that then got remade into a Western by Sergio Leone. And he always denied that he had some sort of like outwardly Western leanings. I think it just sort of meant that I think he just sort of absorbed some of these, you know, more Western stylings maybe, or, I don't know. Like, I can just imagine him seeing John Stagecoach or whatever and being like, oh, John Ford is for me. And just sort of, in the back of his head, he just has certain things from John Ford, and it's just like, this is what interested me. And as he sits down to start to write, and he didn't initially view himself as a writer, it was something that he learned when his mentor was like, a good filmmaker should know how to be a screenwriter as well. It could have just been something where he was sitting down to write and he's like, okay, where do I start? Where do I start? Where do I start? And you just sort of like, what's the easiest thing? What's the first thing that pops into my head? And it sort of started playing with elements of genre, you know? So I can kind of see, I can see where the Japanese government is coming from. And Kurosawa's movies feel more dangerous than Ozu's movies. Again, with very limited knowledge, but more knowledge than most people. But yeah, I can just sort of see a government being like, Ozu is safer, so that's the name we want to push, you know? And it is really interesting reading about Kurosawa, how throughout his career, his movies seem to be bigger worldwide, or more popular worldwide, more respected worldwide than they were in Japan. As you said, specifically with this movie, with Rashomon, that seems to have become overblown with time. But I mean, post 1960, the story of Kurosawa's career is having difficulty getting films made. It's very surprising, as somebody that learned most of these things earlier this week. Like, I was shocked Kurosawa had trouble making movies, because it's just in my head, he's Akira Kurosawa, you know?
Yeah, no, it's just one of those names to me too. As someone who didn't know a ton about him, it just kind of just seemed unassailable, but it's a different time.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, again, post 1960, it takes years to get movies made. I mean, famously, he was fired off of Tora Tora Tora, or was fired for being like too exhausted by the filmmaking process, which was an insane production. He also attempted suicide in the early 70s. Like, there's a lot of darkness in Kurosawa's story. His biography is just very interesting in general, both from a filmmaking perspective, and just if you want to read about an interesting life, Akira Kurosawa is your man, you know? But yeah, it's just, I don't know. It's amazing how many, and Scorsese is still having this problem. Like, it took him 25 years to make Silence, you know? He had to go to Netflix to make The Irishman. So it is interesting to every once in a while remind myself that most great filmmakers don't have the Stanley Kubrick deal, where it's like Warner Brothers gets a phone call and says, hey, I want to have Nicole Kidman and Tom Cruise walk around New York separately, and then maybe and then Nicole Kidman will say fuck at the end, and that'll be the end of the movie, and they're like, here's $30 million, Stanley, go to England for 6 years, you know? And just so few directors directors who are widely regarded as geniuses have that sort of that benefit of somebody just giving them money, you know?
Yeah. Oh, there's something I want to talk about when we're talking about that camera not moving as well.
Sure.
Just the early use of, I guess, handheld in this one.
Yeah. So that is, I would imagine there's the shot framed from behind Tajimaru that's handheld when he like walks away from the camera. He says, so here's a story, and he, you know, he's testifying, and then cut to. I would imagine that's one of the examples. Yeah, I weirdly didn't notice, which is amazing, because a camera in 1950 is a lot harder to lift than a camera that I used earlier today, you know? Like,
yeah.
So that's always impressive. There are lots of... I feel like there is no first handheld camera movement in the way that we're having this conversation about the first person to shoot the sun through trees. But yeah, it is always interesting to think about how much more difficult it must have been to do this handheld camera work in 1950, given the size of equipment. It's kind of like Dunkirk famously was the first movie to use a lot of IMAX handheld camera work, just because like an IMAX camera is super difficult and super heavy to operate. And I think that's kind of what we're at with Rashomon, just a different, like the 35 millimeter equivalent of that. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think just thematically, the idea that when the camera moves in this way, you know, we have, you know, zooming or panning is something else, but when the camera moves more like a person, which mm-hmm. it seems like someone's just walking behind him at this point, right? It does seem very personal. Just thematically, for this movie of all movies, it just feels as though you stop being an observer at this point, you become a participant. And what this movie says about when you're participating in something, you're kind of conflating your ideas with things, and you're choosing a side, or you're becoming another liar, and you're kind of at fault for this discrepancy in everyone's version of the story. And I think that for what a hassle it must have been, I think it does a lot just related to the story and the themes of this one in particular.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. Optimistic ending for you?
Well, let's talk about the editing first, and then maybe we'll talk about the ending. How's that sound?
Yeah, sure. That's fine. I was looking at the list of directors who do their own editing, and it is big, but still feels like it should be bigger.
So, editing sucks. Like, it's as an editor, I hate editing. I'm just like, it doesn't make sense from a business perspective for me to pay other people to do it, because I'm better than people that I could afford to pay. And I think filmmakers that, I mean, it's even more amazing with Kurosawa that he was editing his own movies, because this is, again, 1950, you're actually splicing film. And it was just so much harder to edit movies than, you know, smash cut to today when Steven Soderbergh is editing his movies on the train ride home from the shoot, you know, like, I don't think Steven Soderbergh would have been editing his own movies if it was 1950, you know, he doesn't start editing until nonlinear editing starts to become popular. And I do, however, and I think Kurosawa is the best example of this, think it's so important for directors to understand editing and or have edited themselves. I think it all of the best aspects of Kurosawa as a filmmaker, I think, come from his editing. And the way that there's just like, again, I said this, there's this current running through Kurosawa movies, and I think it's just in the way that shots connect. And to talk about somebody that was influenced by him heavily, Spielberg famously, his early films, he would storyboard every shot. Like Raiders of the Lost Ark, he storyboarded every shot of that movie. Now every shot of that, like the final movie, there's no way is exactly like all of those storyboards, because you have to add in the realities of location and whatnot, and or Harrison Ford being too sick to shoot a sword fight. But like, that's still thinking like an editor, thinking about the way that shots connect to each other. And the way that I really see this in Kurosawa's movies is that the first movie of his that I saw was Seven Samurai, and it is just nonstop throughout this movie. You will see edits happen while a character is in the middle of emotion. And now it's the simplest like rule of editing. It's cut on motion, you know, like even if you're interviewing a talk or shooting and cutting between two cameras of a talking head, you wait for that moment where the camera or the head rocks back and forth a little bit, just to add some sort of something going on while you edit, just to sort of have the theory being that the viewer is focusing on something other than your edit, and it's that movement, you know, and you don't get caught up in a jarring edit or whatever. But Kurosawa, like, he seemed to be directing characters to physically move so that he could edit from a wide to a close in this movement, this quick movement. And there's a perfect example in Rashomon where Tajumaru, he like is being interrogated while I think he's standing, and he like really like whips his head around a little bit, and we cut into this close-up, and it's just this perfect close-up. And I believe the correct term for the way it was done is called an axial cut, which is to say that the camera is on the same axis in both shots, but the lens changes entirely, and it's sort of it's almost like a jump cut in location as opposed to time, you know, because when say we're talking about Godard jump cuts, it's usually to cut out a piece of time in the middle of a footage, whereas in the middle of the footage where this cuts out geography. And Rashomon does this a handful of times. That shot that I was talking about where the woodcutter and the commoner and the priest are separated with the pillar in between them, the commoner goes to, or the woodcutter, one of those two, goes to either get up or sit down. And on that motion, we cut to a close-up and we see him finishing that movement. And it's just the connection of these shots. There's just this gorgeous framing and the direction to do this action. And characters in these movies, as such, are often more physically active than normal human beings are, just because Kurosawa wants something to cut on. And those are the types of things that I think Kurosawa does better than anybody that I've ever had experience with their films. And I think that axial cut is really his like superhero move. And he does it pretty frequently, but it always works, you know, and that's sort of what helps keep you in the feel of the movie. Like we've always said, edits are, the goal of an edit is to not be seen. And Kurosawa is really great at hiding his edits.
Yeah, another thing I meant to mention earlier, not particularly on the point of editing, but one thing that I did want to make sure I do mention is that the fight scenes are way better than I anticipated them being.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Because, I mean, we think of George Lucas being inspired by these and, you know, the lightsaber battles during the first trilogy are just much more slow-paced, and for a movie that it's stylized, especially by the time we get the second sword fight, which is, you know, less kind of honorable, less of a glorious fight, more swords getting stuck and people falling over and not looking kind of the stylized, mm-hmm. Glamorized version that you might tell somebody is the way that your fight went down. It looks so much better. And again, no one's complained about Asian cinemas that the fight scenes aren't good. But, I was surprised for 1950 that it wasn't as slow and staged and obviously kind of choreographed out as things, you know, almost three decades later, like A New Hope was.
Yeah, no, I agree. I'm sure we agree that like the last sword fight we see in the movie, just that it's clumsy and both characters seem scared during it, is just a really cool little flip on the way we're used to seeing sword fighting in the movie, where everybody's just confident, like, this isn't a life or death situation, whatever, I'm Errol Flynn, I'm Robin Hood, whatever, this is fine.
Yeah, and especially samurais, who are usually, you know, the unspoken, kind of very calm, collected, yeah, even of all the kind of sword fighters. I thought that was an interesting way to do that, and an extremely realistic way in a movie that, as I said, isn't always the most concerned with that facet of it.
Yeah, exactly. Like, the realism of that scene is almost jarring, both from the side of this is not how we're used to seeing sword fights in films, and also that it feels truthful in a movie that a lot of times feels so exaggerated. And just in general, I think that sequence is really, really interesting because of that. Since we were talking about how fantastic the editing in this movie is, I feel like it should be pointed out that this movie had 1 week of post-production time.
Yeah.
That's insane. Like, they shot for 5 weeks and edited for one. That's unbelievable. But yeah, I don't have anything other than that to offer on it. Just one other very Kurosawa things. We talked about water and well, the rain and the sun, but I think the use of leaves and the forest in general, I thought was really interesting. And all of those shots in profile as characters are running through the forest, and you just see these leaves going in front of them. It's just, they're just beautiful shots, and also very visually engaging, and there's so much movement going on. And also just the idea of using the forest as sort of this place where it's hard to like place yourself because everything looks the same. It's the forest, you know, and it just sort of feels like they're just sort of lost in this abyss of sorts. And I thought that was a really, another cool visual metaphor in this movie.
Yeah. We talk about the importance of geography in, kind of all movies, but especially action movies. But I think, as you said, this one to be this abyss or this place where it is hard to place yourself. And, you know, we're trying to grapple with all these different people's versions of the stories at the same time. And I think it's very on point that you can kind of quickly lose yourself in where you are and whose position and you're standing in what you're looking at. And everyone has their own subjectivity and informs them. And I mean, just to go back to what I was saying about these people all claiming to be the murderer, which you think is the one thing that they would try to get away from. I think that their reasoning behind it is informed by what they think. I mean, the bandits version of the story that we were kind of talking about, that sword fight, it seems like he wishes he had kind of been sort of braver and fighting with more honor. So it's his fight that is that first very dramatic battle that we discussed. Mm-hmm. And it is that kind of classic samurai story that we picture of two very noble warriors with their backs up straight and they cross swords 23 times and, you know, they're not tripping over tree stumps or getting their sword caught in the ground and things like that. And I think that in the Weiss version of the story, I think that she feels that she was responsible for her husband's death in no matter how the story went down. Mm-hmm. And so she literally kills him in this one, whereas I think that that's more of a illustration of the guilt that she feels. Mm-hmm. The samurai, he feels betrayed, and so his story, he kills himself. You know, he's the one that's responsible for it. And the woodcutters' versions of the story is a bit tricky, as we said. It's the one that seems to be closest to the truth, but it seems like this is a story he's not not that he's not interested in it, but he just sort of feels passive in it. You know, mm-hmm. I think that he feels that he's not really involved with the story and that he wishes that he wasn't even part of it. And so the way that he tries to get away with his telling initially, at least, is that he just found it and that he's sort of pushing the story away from him. And I think that's one of the most interesting things in this story, because if you told me that it's four different people's version of a murder, I would assume everybody's blaming the other people. Mm-hmm. And that the crux of it is just, it's so much more internal. It's not about externalizing this blame and saying which of these other three people did it and why. It's telling it in the way that even if you did it, is the one that aligns most with your value systems. And I think that for a whodunit, for the answer to be me, but for the right reasons, I would totally see that as a curveball now. Yeah. So let alone that this is being done in 1950, I think is kind of one of the big takeaways for me. And I think that's infinitely interesting if it was done today. So the fact that we're looking at almost 70 years ago, I think speaks to something that's very, very immediate and interesting about a movie that's now pretty old.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think I guess the only thing I really have to add about the ending was, the rain stops and characters start to walk out from under that gate, I was sort of struck by how bright it felt. Like, it felt too, for the rest of the movie, like given the rest of the movie, it felt too bright, too sunny, you know, after the rain had cleared out. And, it just sort of felt too optimistic to me that like things have been resolved, you know, like the rain is so gone that the sun is now out. And I found it really interesting to learn that Kurosawa had planned for it to be overcast, but the sun didn't go away, you know? And I just sort of found that really interesting. And it kind of, It's interesting to know, like, kind of the one thing that jumped out to me as something that I didn't like about this movie, or that sort of sat with me hit me the wrong way. It's really interesting to know that Kurosawa intended something else, and something that probably would have been feels perfect. You know, just the idea that the sun's not out, like it's overcast, and the storm, there could just be another storm right around the corner at any point, and you're hiding under this gate trying to deal with all this, or hide from all, or shield yourself from all this uncertainty once again. And and I just thought that was really fascinating to know that, like, something that felt wrong to me felt wrong to Kurosawa as well, and that he was making these, like, you know, just picturing him 70 years previous, like, just staring up in the sky and hoping for a cloud to cross the sun for 3 minutes, and that that just never happened. It's just so, that's fascinating to me, you know. It's a,
yeah,
I don't know, the realities of filmmaking in the real world are just endlessly interesting, and this one just is one of those realities that happens at such an important moment that it totally changes how I felt about the film, at least temporarily, until doing copious amounts of research.
Yeah, and my takeaway from that is, I mean, I think less practical filmmaking, but that in this movie about you not being able to properly describe the truth, he wasn't able to tell the story that he wanted to tell.
Yeah, no, that's true.
That's what I find so fascinating about that, and that it is that, you know, the ending is, you know, arguably the most important part. It's the part that you remember the most, and the part that is kind of there to drive things home. And I think that the fact that in this movie he wasn't able to show the world the way he wanted to show it is pretty incredible.
Yeah. So that's it for this episode of the MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check back next time. We'll be talking about something else.